So, Mike, you were Southern Baptist, became an atheist. You were a rapture guy.
I was a rapture guy. Yeah, for sure.
Did you ever think you got left behind?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was really worried about whether I was really saved or not, because I would read Revelation and I would like read about the horrible things depicted there, and because the dominant theology of the church I was going to was premillennialist, I think is what they call it, that the Christians are raptured first thing. I didn't want to be part of like getting stung by scorpions or having to have a mark of the beast in order to do commerce and have to refuse it and then starve to death. All those things didn't sound like fun, interesting, uplifting things. But I was often terrified that I'd like somehow botch the salvation process because of reading Revelation and end times theology.
So eschatology, guys, this is the episode on eschatology. We had several people just asking while we've been doing this podcast for subjects along this line, what happens at the end, eschatology. And we finally did it. We're going to brave it. We each had to have a little drink, and we're both super lightweights. We haven't even finished our one beer, and we're both already a little...
little tipsy. Yeah. I'd ask a friend to help me get the laptop ready to record, because it was confusing me.
But if you're talking about eschatology...
You have to.
You got to wet that whistle a
little
bit.
Such a weird topic, and kind of a downer. Like, what's the end? Is it good? Is it bad? Ooh.
Well, here we go. We're diving in, guys. Welcome to the Liturgist Podcast, Eschatology, where we discuss issues through the lenses of art, faith, and science. Might as well talk about art. We're here. We're in beautiful Laguna right now and overlooking the ocean. So it's interesting because as those of you that aren't theology nerds, eschatology means it's basically the end times, right? It's the study of the end times. And it's a subject that is sort of controversial because everybody disagrees about it. Even within the Christian tradition, there are so many ways of reading the Bible in this. There's no one clear, simple, straightforward, everybody, you know, this is what the Bible says about eschatology. If there were that sort of explanation, there'd probably be more consistency on how people interpret it. But it's all over the place. You've got people that think there's going to be some sort of rapture. You have people that believe in, there are Christians that don't believe in any sort of afterlife. There are Christians that believe in a really dualistic, you either go to this other place called heaven or this other place called hell. There are people that believe that there's a resurrection all on earth and that it's all made new and there's some sort of heaven or hell present within the earth reality. It's just all over the map. Certainly there are streams of Christian thought that go back farther than others. You know, there was the dispensationalist thing in the 19th century that really kind of spread into a lot of evangelical and American Christianity. That's where a lot of the rapture stuff really started getting talked about for the first time with Darby and all that. And it's just, but it just, it's broad and it's wide and it's very hotly contested. So we're just going to tell you from the bat, we don't know.
And I, like, my whole background in eschatology comes from two perspectives, my Southern Baptist childhood and my atheistic crisis of faith. So the only two things I know really well are the most conservative position and the position that the whole discipline is nonsense. And I don't really have, I get a little nervous because Michael talked about doing an eschatology episode. I said, one, nobody knows what that is. Nobody's going to care. And two, what do I have to add? But then when we kind of tweeted out and went to Facebook and said, hey, we're doing an episode, what do you guys think? Lots of responses really quick, so I feel like it's a good episode to cover. And if we're going to talk about the art of eschatology, you can't do that unless you're willing to talk about the Left Behind series.
That's true. Mr. Kirk Cameron. Mr. Nicolas Cage these days.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen it?
I have not.
I haven't either.
But how did they get Nicolas Cage to do a Left Behind movie? Kudos to them.
Cash money, I'm thinking.
Cash money. Nicholas must have some debts.
Yeah, did you see the Kirk Cameron one?
I'm going to, if you just ask, have you seen, and if it's any of that genre, it's going to be no.
I saw the Kirk Cameron Left Behind movie.
Whoa.
And because I read the entire series.
You did.
I did. It's not a joke that I was a Southern Baptist. I was an actual Southern Baptist. That was real. So I read those books because there were so many things that confused me in Revelation. I thought this novelization would help me understand the theology. I'm not kidding. And so I read those books. Well, like, so I read the whole series, but then it like spun off into like more series. And that was around the time I was starting to look at things through a little bit more of a progressive Christian lens, so I didn't keep following it.
Hmm. But what about the Omega Code? Did you ever see the Omega Code?
No. No, I didn't.
It's another one of those. I don't know what it is, but I assume Mr. Kirk Cameron is in it.
But here's the thing to me about Left Behind. It's not like the best writing, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, folks, if you disagree. Just it's a podcast. I get to share my opinion. But, man, a lot of people bought those books.
Yeah.
And those books were widely discussed. And so there might be a tendency in some mental spaces to discount the really conservative, really literalist readings of scripture and how that has implications for eschatology. But the art of the Left Behind series shows us that what you believe about the end of all things has a dramatic effect on your creativity as a person, mm-hmm. the things that you value, and the way that you behave in the world. So even though it's a weird word and kind of obscure, I think the degree to which Left Behind tapped into the consciousness of a large group of mainly Americans, but it sold overseas as well, is really telling. This idea that the earth as a temporary phenomenon, we're really just here to sell as many Jesus insurance policies as possible and then get out before it all falls apart, that really has ripples. And I even wonder how much that limits people's creativity and their art. Mm-hmm. Because if all we're here to do is go through this trial to be saved and help others to be saved, then the only art worth creating is art that says Jesus, 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 Jesus. Mm-hmm. And everything else is either neutral or dangerous. And that's actually, I had good parents. They weren't super conservative. But for my early youth, I wasn't allowed to listen to non-Christian music or records. I didn't consume Christian media that existed outside the church. And that creates a pretty limited perspective on the world because of the way art informs our view of reality. Art lets us, as we've talked about on the program before, step back and look at our own lens and then look through someone else's lens. When you believe, all I got to do is make it till they ring the bell and I vanish and my clothes are left in the chair, it makes really bad art. And I hate to do a value judgment like that, but it does.
I agree. I have experienced that personally. I feel like musically we went through a pretty major shift when we became Gunger. And I used to be the Michael Gunger band. And there was some stuff that we made we made one album as the Michael Gunger band. And I'm still happy with some of that stuff that we did, but there was a definite shift that happened in my art, personally, when specifically my eschatology changed. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in the same sort of vibe where art in dispensationalist or like a lot of evangelical sort of viewpoints, where it just has an element of escapism to it, mm-hmm. right? Like we've got to get your golden ticket and wait till the end so that you don't get left behind or that you get your ticket in. There was no reason for art to be sacred within that story outside of, like you said, if it's very specifically about that story. So the image that I kind of got was, you saw the movie Titanic where the string players are like playing on the deck while the ship
that
is going down. And it was like, it was kind of funny and beautiful, but it was also like, it seemed so pointless. You know, like, what are you doing? Why are you still doing that? You're still trying to do your little job and this ship is sinking. There's an absurdity about it, right?
Right.
And that was sort of art in in my circle growing up. It was like, yeah, we have these artists. You can go, I guess, practice your guitar and do your art thing. That's nice. But if you want to do work for the kingdom, you know, you better, if you're going to be a painter, a Christian painter that really takes the glory of God seriously, the kingdom of God seriously, paint some crosses. And to be like, and that makes sense on the ship, on the Titanic, if you're going to be a painter and you want to be effective in that moment, you should paint signs to the exit. And that's about it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to be painting murals on the wall of the Titanic. It's going down. And if you want to be effective on the Titanic as an artist, figure out how to get us off this ship. I'm sure there are people that believe in the rapture that make fine art. You know, I don't think this is just a blanket statement to say if you believe this sort of eschatology, you're not going to make good art. But for me personally, when I started reading some N.T. Wright and stuff like that, where in his eschatology, which is more Anglican and, you know, probably which is closer to the Catholic and older Orthodox views of Christian eschatology, meaning the restoration of all things, the you know, kind of a new earth, new heavens, new earth sort of eschatology, that it made me view human work differently altogether, including art and music, and how it's all part, like the kingdom of God in that way of seeing is being birthed among us through the very ordinary work and art and way that we are ordering the earth, and that's part of how God is bringing the kingdom into the world, and that eventually all things are made new, and the Titanic may sink for a minute, but then those same boards are used to rebuild or whatever, you know. I think that was an N.T. Wright idea, maybe, or example. But anyway, thinking that way, all of a sudden, I don't know what it was, but something shifted away from, because I always wanted my art to please God. I always wanted it to be part of, I wanted to give God glory and not myself. I wanted to be a part of something bigger than myself. I didn't just want to make music so that I'd be rich and famous. I wanted to make music that it would help people and that it would serve God and his purposes in the world. But I thought to do that, the way my eschatology really aimed me in a kind of narrow direction, a narrow box where I had to fit this, be an exit sign painter of sorts. And then when that shifted and got a little broader and that all, you know, in a different eschatology, I was able to say, oh, well, maybe there's things that I could just create for the sake of creating within this world of this new way of seeing the world, that it's sacred within itself. And it really, just that eschatology change really drastically changed the way I approach my writing and my art, that I didn't have to keep pushing something a certain direction for it to be sacred, for it to be good, for it to be worth something. That really anything that we did from our hearts, from our, that was in a true and honest and meaningful way, that was the worship of it, not the context. I mean, what context we end up playing the music in or the words in the music if we have enough Jesuses per minute. It was, that had very little to do with the actual, like, sacred nature of it. And so that changed it. And then when I lost my faith, that changed it again. So I do think that the eschatology, the view of that we have at the end, I think you're right. It does have a significant impact on what we make of our world and how we treat our world, including our art.
Well, it's relational too. So like it used to be every talk I gave in a church context, there might be some teaching in there, some discipleship, but it always led to a crescendo of turn or burn. Everyone. Everything I wrote for a devotional or in anything I produced had this message of avoid the end, right? I used to say that everybody's immortal. It's just a matter of where you'll be. And then I sort of started to look at more other Christian views of the end, other Christian views of salvation. And I, of course, as you would imagine, these days I'm really into especially the Greek Orthodox views of salvation in the end, because they look at everything in terms of sickness and healing. And then the end is us being drawn toward the divine, and in that way being healed and becoming like God. And I just think that's a beautiful image. But it changed the way that I communicated about spiritual things. So even while I was still going to an evangelical church, I was starting to incorporate some of those themes into the work that I did and the messages I delivered and the things that I wrote. And they became, in some ways, more hopeful. Because with a less binary view of what may happen at the end of things. And then, you know, obviously for me, as we'll talk about this more later, I started to wrestle with the science of things. Mm-hmm. And then I stopped believing, closet atheist. And so that completely shifted the tone of even my religious art or religious work, because now it was, who cares what happens in the end? What can I convince you to change, or how can I inspire you today? And at least for me, that's when I started to actually gain any traction with people and see more response to the work that I did. Nothing like I see today, but there was definitely that pivot point. And I didn't realize until you were talking that was completely attached to a change in eschatology.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird.
That's insane.
It's weird.
This episode matters.
It's weird because most people that I talk to, and maybe I do live in a small bubble, of course, we all do, but most people that I have talked to about this are like, I don't know. I mean, most people that are reasonable people, I think, I have some level of, I don't know.
Right.
Because we don't know. But how important it is in affecting how we live. It's interesting how so many of us don't have any idea what we think about it. But maybe that's part of the mystery of how you handle it is maybe an important part of even...
Even when I talk to really conservative people, a lot of them will say, well, I think...
Yeah.
But, like, it's a pretty small slice. It's like, no, here it is.
Yeah.
These scriptures say this is what's going to happen. And I guess I see a little of that, but it's like the, like, really almost like theology nerd fringe that gets, like, really worked up over your eschatology.
Well, because if we're honest, the only eschatology I think that you see even in Scripture is art. Like, is poetry, is apocalyptic language. There's no, like, straight up, here's how scientifically the end of all things is going to look. It uses imagery, the style of writing, the style of speaking. Even when Jesus is talking about hell, he uses words like the Gehenna or whatever, like a garbage dump outside of Jerusalem. Why wasn't he just speaking? There's no straight talk about it. It seems it's all metaphor. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but everything I'm thinking of is it uses poetry and imagery, and which to me at this point where I'm at totally makes sense, because how can you speak of the unknowable without that? If you can see kind of like, I had this, one of the things as I've been kind of post my deconstruction, trying to figure out, because I don't know where I'm at today, eschatologically, but one thing I do think is that if there is some sort of after existence after our death, I mean, it's going to have to be such an entirely different way of existing for it not to be hell. You know, like if it's anything like this sort of existence, just better, if it's like just like it is now, but just more fun or more beautiful. If you talk about infinity added to that, I was realizing, like, we're out here, like I said, we're in Laguna, and we have this gorgeous view. And how long would I be able to enjoy this view? I could enjoy it for a long time. Maybe years.
Until the first mortgage payment.
That's true. No, but, like, I could sit up here for a while. And then maybe in my, you know, resurrected self, I could sit here for a million years and enjoy this. Maybe a billion years and be like, and I could go around and look at every flower individually. And I could do that with every cliff on this whole coast. I could do that over every cliff and every plain, every mountain in the whole world. And I could do that on every planet in the whole universe. And I could do it and be like still amazed and then come back and be like, I'm going to do it all again. And I could do it all a billion times. And then at what point I'm like, cool, like I've seen this a lot of times. You know, like if there's any sort of finite way of experiencing it, like we experience time and space now, that's hell. I'd eventually be like, I'm cool. Like I've seen this. I'm cool to go now. Like, you know what I mean? So I have to think there's some other way of being. If there is some sort of existence after this, it's got to be so entirely different on some level that it is a great mystery. So that gives me, like, do I have some hope, I guess, for that sort of mystery? Sure. But it also makes me see this life as incredibly special and unique and temporary in a way that's not like it used to. I was with you. Actually, as a rapture kid, I didn't think I was going to die. How many people on Earth don't think they're going to die? That's a weird thing.
Statistically? I'm guessing, like legitimately think that's a significant possibility is total spitballing. I mean, I'm doing some reasonable statistical estimate. So if you consider 16% or so are like what we'd call true evangelicals of the United States population, of that, what do you think?
But that also think that Jesus is probably coming back
in their lifetime. That's what I'm saying. So I'm guessing that's probably 10% or less of that group. But that still could be a few hundred thousand people in the U.S.
Yeah, that don't believe they're going to die.
Are at least 50%.
Which are the only people on Earth, right? I mean, there's no other religions that don't think they're going to die. Maybe some UFO cult or something.
Yeah, I mean, the occasional cult would also think that. So I want to go back to something you said about poetic language and the end. Mm-hmm. And I'm about to throw a hand grenade on the program. So if you just don't want to comment on anything I'm saying, you feel free.
Okay.
But, you know, that's the good thing about starting out my career with heresy.
And a beer. On this podcast.
The Bible is certainly most poetic at two points in its language, the very end and the very beginning.
Yeah.
Right? There's no question. Like, no one can read Revelation and not say there's some degree
of sword coming out of his mouth.
Exactly. Yeah. Does Jesus have metal feet? No, he does not have metal feet. So there are places where the Bible discusses the end in terms that are not as poetic.
All right.
The Gospels.
Sheep and goats? I think they're literally going to be sheep and goats?
No, but I mean in terms of many of you will not, you'll live until when I come back.
Okay.
Right? So whoever wrote that Gospel is attributing those words to Christ. Mm-hmm. And I think the most reasonable reading of that text is that author believed in his lifetime Christ would return and renew all things. And that belief has just persisted.
Which makes sense of some of the other scriptures, like Paul saying, you know, if you have to marry right now,
right,
go ahead.
Yes, the epistles.
But why not just wait?
Explore those ideas more. And so I think you do Christianity a disservice when you try to whitewash the idea that in some ways this really was at the very beginning an apocalyptic movement. We are here to orient our lives to prepare for an earth that is almost done. Mm-hmm. And I don't whitewash that stuff, right? That's the value, at least to me, in the way I read the Bible as a library, a collection of human works about God, is it means it doesn't freak me out if they might have missed something. Now, I know maybe I'll get another blog post on Answer in Genesis from this. If you guys are listening, hello. I just think it frees you up to not be so obsessed with, no, these guys had to be right about everything. And I think the Gospels are pretty clear. They thought this stuff was happening soon. And I think in the light of how people understood God in that era, that wasn't a crazy assumption. I think it might be a little more of a stretch in 2015, though.
Here's a question from Justin Moore on Twitter. Is there an absolute essential thing necessary to know about the end times for one's faith? Example, knowing how Jesus comes back benefits my faith in blank ways, etc. I understand and believe it's kind of the point for Christianity. Jesus comes for his bride. Eschatology never ends there. What do you think, Mike?
Before we started this episode, I would have said, no, it doesn't matter. Right? And yeah. Now I'm like, well, let's see. When my eschatology has changed, it has dramatically changed my life. Hmm. It has changed the way I behave. It has changed the way I communicate. But there's another thing in there. Is there anything essential to believe? So I have, because of the way I view salvation, essential is a weird word for me, mm-hmm. right? I'm kind of a universalist, kind of with the Orthodox and this idea of healing through the cosmic Christ, kind of a hippie that way. So, but in terms of essential, I think this idea, this belief that somehow God is drawing us to him and that reconciliation and reunification are the arc of all things, helps us to behave in different ways, especially in hopeless times. So I think about like happiness studies I've seen and how people in wealthy and industrialized nations tend to be less happy than many people in poor, less developed nations. And those people often have higher levels of religiosity. And so they sort of look at their current circumstances, and even though in many ways they're kind of crummy, they think it's okay. God is drawing me towards this thing, and they're still able to behave. I went to Guatemala once, and I was blown away by the hospitality and generosity of people who would invite me into their home, and they had, like, nothing. And they'd bring, like, this plate of, like, snack cakes and soda, and, like, it was rude to refuse it, right? But they gave generously out of their poverty because they believed that had a spiritual value. But then they genuinely enjoyed the time and the fellowship with you. And that attitude, I guess you could say it's altruism or whatever, it doesn't make as much sense in a materialist or a non-spiritual context. And even in my own life, when I look at sometimes the downers of the world, the hopeless things, the fact that I believe, and I do, that God is drawing all things to the divine, I think that might be essential, you can't see the air quotes, to Christian faith.
I'm going to be a little bit pragmatic and say that what I think is essential is not the contents of the beliefs, but the consequences of those beliefs. So if you have a belief system, for example, that paints a picture of a scary God that you're afraid of, that you try to appease in some way with your faith, and maybe you do that with your beliefs, however that works, you do that with your actions, that might not be the healthiest eschatology. If you have an eschatology that makes the world, separates you from other people in a really existential way, where you are somehow part of this group that is the group and everybody else is not the group, and you are separated from people, and you know that you're the sheep and they're the goats, that's concerning, I think. I think if your eschatology doesn't essentially lead you to love, if it doesn't lead you towards deeper connection and love of God, of your neighbor, and even of yourself, I think there's probably some room for some bulldozers to come into that eschatology, because it is important what we believe about the end, how we even what we hope for the end. And because the reality is, if Kirk Cameron is correct in his eschatology, then he really is doing the right thing. He really is, like,
that's right,
standing on the corner and telling people they're going to hell. And because, have you ever had an adultery? Have you ever lusted after a woman? Well, then you're going to, Jesus says you've committed adultery then. So you've broken the Ten Commandments. You're going to hell. You need to pray this prayer with me. that's the only loving thing to do.
Penn Jillette said that, right? Like, if you really believe that I don't believe certain things, I'm going to hell, and you don't evangelize, how much do you hate me?
Yeah, it's yeah. true. But then, you know, I would challenge Mr. Cameron to see how that sort of perspective paints God and paints our neighbors and paints ourselves. It paints us in this very privileged small group of people who are in with God, who is this very scary, tyrannical being, and it paints others as the enemy of God. And from everything I know about Jesus, if you're standing with Jesus, you're standing with the enemy. So in that sort of view, like, it kind of eats itself, because how are you not going to be with the oppressed in that situation rather than the oppressor?
Well, and from a literary perspective, you have these people using sacrifice language to a culture steeped in animal sacrifice.
Yeah.
But then we just like, well, let's use that metaphor forever. I think it's much more interesting to consider the cross, for example, in the context of God's response to our wrath and anger, as opposed to appeasing his own. Like, I think atheists actually offer an interesting critique when they say, so what you're telling me is God sent himself in the form of his own son so he could save us from his own wrath. Like, it just, I guess you can call that a mystery and then try to hold on to it, but to me it's just kind of nonsensical. And it makes more sense if in some way the cross shows us how God suffers along with us. And maybe causes us to question some of those assumptions about his nature and how things will end.
So yeah, essential to me at this point, and I'm still working out what I think or what I even hope for the end, but maybe if there is, you know, if the Bible is revealing something about the end, maybe the fact that it is all just this crazy poetic mix of images and apocalyptic insanity should make us, even within the very system, hold the whole thing with loose hands, but also be able to wrestle through and what are we hope for? What sort of hope do we see at the end of all this? Where is this moving at the end of this story? Because even when I was a kid, I remember hearing some of these preachers talk about the Mark of the Beast and stuff, and you were going to get this, you know, I don't know how it turned into like a barcode. Where did that come from?
I actually know this one.
Okay.
Because the whole idea is it's a mark on the head or the hand. That's the scripture.
Yeah.
And that it's the mark
necessary
of the beast.
For commerce.
And that this, yes, necessary for commerce. And that there is this mathematical derivative nature to this mark in which it can be distilled to 666. And if you look...
But that's not in the... Where's the mathematical derivative? Oh, that it says...
That's an interpretation. In some translations, it says, and for those of you who are good with numbers, let you know this number will work too. But then that translator is the one that turned to 666. Anyway, whatever.
But who first said, so that's a barcode?
Well, I guess my crew, because in youth group, they showed us a barcode, and if you've ever seen a UPC code, there's these calibration marks at the beginning, the middle, and the end, and on every barcode. And somehow in wacko eschatology land, that came to be those three marks were a six, a six, and a six. And so then, what you say, what I love about this memetically, so I know we're still in science, I'm just kind of, or in faith, I'm going to add just a touch of science because it intersects.
Yes.
Is watching this meme evolve. So UPCs were this interesting way where a mark was used to execute commerce. And so people are reading the scriptures, and because of their eschatology, informing the way they view the world, looking for warning signs. Mm-hmm. So a UPC became a possible vector to know when it was ready to be ready,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So if suddenly instead of it's the UPC is on the bread but also on your hand and you pay with your hand, now we're in trouble. Today, the same chatter is going along, but over RFID. Since you can inject a chip that's scannable, which you totally could conceivably get a grain of rice-sized chip and inject it into your hand or into your forehead and scan it and do contact payment, for example.
I'd take it.
I'd take it in a second. But the whole thing, even if, so, but let's be clear before, like, the angry emails start. Even those scriptures denote that this would not be a subtle process, that there would be some pledge of fealty or engagement with this one world power in order to get the mark. So somebody just offers like the Apple Watch will have Apple Pay. That doesn't mean that it's on your wrist. It's like the end times. It just means it's an easy way to pay for things with an encryption token.
But I, even in high school, I was starting to like see that and be like, wait. So this story, let me get this straight. Like, the whole thing that we always talk about is we don't have to live under this law anymore, this code. What I do, all I need to do is like, you know, kind of trust Jesus and receive Jesus, and then grace covers all of my sins. But then if like I get a chip in my hand, then I'm going to go burn in hell for eternity. You know, even within the very system, I was like, wait, but doesn't that kind of contradict?
Well, then you were never saved. Thing? Then you were falsely saved the first time.
Falsely saved.
Yeah, you had a false assurance of salvation that was validated the moment you accepted the mark. Mm. I studied this stuff
but
pretty intensely.
It's like, it like all of a sudden gets external again. Like the whole thing was the law was external, and now it's internal, this heart change, and then now it's back to external at the end.
Well, the way I've seen it described in apologetics, man, I forgot how much I know about this stuff, is that anyone who would take that mark had never accepted salvation in the first place. So
you guys were once saved, always saved.
Once saved, always saved. Okay. Oh, yeah. So that meant never
saved. We were not. I was charismatic. You could lose your salvation. Yeah.
Well, you guys were heretics. That's okay.
Okay. Well, you shipwreck your faith, you know? That was the Pauline way of saying
it. We call that backsliding. Yeah, because your faith is never in question. Once you're saved, that's it.
If we listened to ourselves as young people, we would be the biggest backsliders in the whole world.
If I heard this podcast when I was 19, I'd be the one sending the angry email. Like, and first it'd be angry, and then it would be a plea for my soul. That's exactly how that would go. I'm totally serious. Because I would, like, watch things and be like, oh, these people, this is dangerous. It's dangerous for them. I remember this band came to our church, and I was talking to the bass player because he's a really good bass player, and I realized he smoked cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, but I wasn't, like, angry with him. I was grieved. I was like, does he know the Lord? You know what I mean? Is he, anyway, crazy.
Maybe we are backslidden, Mike.
Maybe. I don't know.
Only if the 13-year-old programmer is God.
Yeah, exactly. I feel a resurrection life happening to me awful frequently.
Okay, so one thing I guess that was part of that question that we didn't get to is the kind of point for Christianity. And this, I mean, from the early creeds and everything, Jesus' return is, how can you separate that from Christianity? That's a pretty major point of eschatology for Christians. What that looks like, of course, has widely interpreted truths. But you also have things like Paul saying, you know, if there is no resurrection from the dead, then we are to be pitied above everybody. So I think there are some, like, while there are a million branches of Christian thought, if you look at most of those branches, there is some eschatological element of Christ's resurrection and resurrection of all things at the end. How that works, what that looks like, if it's true, I guess that's up to your discretion, listener.
Well, but that's where I lean into the biblical ideas of hope.
Yeah.
So I don't know what happens. And I don't know exactly what resurrection of the dead means. And sorry, my skeptical friends, this is where you guys get to roll your eyes at me. This is why I'm not an atheist anymore. But I believe in this reconciliation, and I have some hopes for the promises of Scripture. Even though, you know, I get all these questions all the time about, well, if parts are mythical, how can you put faith in any of it, right? And I just, because of the way I've experienced these stories in my own life. You know what I mean? And I get that could just be rooted in my neurological composition. I get it could be innate cognitive biases. But leaning into these stories in some way has helped a few billion people over a couple thousand years know and understand the thing that we call God. And so I'm okay leaning into some mystery, and I'm okay putting some trust and hope in completely non-empirical ideas about where things are going.
As I wrestle myself with trying to develop an eschatology at this point again, I have conflicting thoughts, because on one side, when I kind of lost my really happy eschatology, I had to come to terms with death in a way that I hadn't before. And that was actually really healthy for me. And Ecclesiastes is there in our Bible. If you read Ecclesiastes, that was our first meditation, was on this whole idea of vapor and like everything is meaningless and coming to terms with death. And like what you're doing and all we get worried about, stressed out about on a cosmic scale it's nothing. It's just a mist at best. It's a vapor, Havel. And coming to terms with that, I think that stream is it's in our Bible. It's in our tradition. Coming to terms with death and seeing that. And I don't know whether the teacher believed in an afterlife or not.
Right.
But
scholarship would have you to believe that the Hebraic understanding of the afterlife was radically different than the modern Christian understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Annihilationism was a perfectly valid afterlife view for most of the Jewish part of this.
And then there was Sheol and the place of the dead eventually that kind of developed. But
even Sheol was like a kind of a temporary thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that in the Bible you have, that it seems the writers don't even all have a consistent vision of what the afterlife is. You know? I was able to come to terms with death, but there's also the other side, the hopeful side of that. My work, my life, and not just my work, but my life, but the humankind's existence and life. Like, I want to believe that Mother Teresa, that her work mattered on some level that wasn't just in that, you know, in that hospital with that one kid. Like, I believe, you know, that's enough. That's enough, I think. But that there is some sort of, like, bigger thing that's connected to. I love that idea because if we can think that the little things that we do is connected to some bigger direction of the way things are going, and that Christian hope, that the reason, I think that Christian hope is a reason that there are Mother Teresa's in the world, a big part of the reason that it is connected to some bigger story, some bigger direction. And so I think that death is something to be embraced in a, you know, the fact that my daughter Amelie, she's 4, she just went to preschool recently, and I had a date with her like the day before she went to preschool, and I realized this was the last date that I'm going to have with Amelie before she's a school kid. And it was like, it made it so, like, brought tears to my eyes, and I was just so profoundly present and thankful for every moment of that date. Not because it was an eternal thing that I'd be able to do over and over and over, but it was because this is it. This is what I've got. And the fact that she's going to grow up and get out of the house makes every night that I get to go into her bedroom and read her a story and give her a kiss goodnight every time. There's a very limited amount of those that I have. And soon she's, you know, so that makes it special. Like, the limited lifespan that we have on this earth to experience life as we experience it now comes to an end. And that is scary for a lot of us, but it also is what makes life so precious and is what makes every moment so valuable. And so I think both of those things have something to teach us, both the temporary nature and that which is beyond. And even if that which is beyond is something very scientific and very like, my dust goes into Stardust again, and I'm part of the big thing, you know, whatever. Like, I need, there should be something. I want something in my eschatology that is bigger than just it's me, and then I'm gone. That I'm part of something bigger. And I'm.
Did you ever read I Am a Strange Loop?
I haven't.
So Douglas Hofstadter is a computer scientist, philosopher who considers consciousness. He's also obviously I shouldn't say obviously, but kind of is obviously an atheist, or at least non-spiritual. And his wife died. And so he starts to wrestle with what is the afterlife? What's that look like? And so if you consider our consciousness and who we are as essentially a pattern, right? So the most obvious thing would be our DNA. Obviously, as you said, the components, our constituent materials, our protons, our neutrons, our electrons, they're effectively eternal. They're as eternal as this variation of the universe. And so we will continue to form life after we are no longer life. But also, if you have children, the loom that created you will persist in them, your DNA. But even forget that. The thing that you most identify with you is not actually your DNA, and twins prove that. You don't think you are your twin. You that you associate with you is a particular pattern and relationship that exists in a neural network, right? It changes over time, but there's some essential essence that, short of Alzheimer's or something like that, remains consistent throughout your life and everyone recognizes as you. And so what's interesting about human consciousnesses and human brains is they're constantly building and updating models of reality. And so we get upset when our models are wrong. So if you have a favorite chair and you sit in that chair and it falls down, a leg falls off, you're going to be a little nervous to sit on it for a while because you realize your model wasn't quite right. And we really freak out when our models about people are wrong, right? So someone you're close to does something unpredictable that creates stress and anxiety. It's all going somewhere really cool. What that means is for the better someone knows you, the higher resolution a map of your particular neural network they are building in their own. And so when I was an atheist and my grandmother died, I really was grieving and I read this book. And I realized that in a very real way, I could contemplate a question and I could tell you exactly how my meemaw would answer it. And the reason I could do that is because if you imagine the original person as a painting, I at least had like a mosaic tile version of that painting in my own brain. And that as long as I thought of her and remembered her, in a very materialist sense, I carried that which was her with me.
Yeah.
And that meant the more I invested in other people, the more I allowed them to build a model of me and I in return, I did create some form, some echo of afterlife. I Am a Strange Loop is a great book if you guys want to check it out.
And that's interesting when you even want to, back to the Mother Teresa thing, she exists in how many hearts and brains in the world that when we encounter the broken, she has something to do with, she lives on it in so many hearts, you know, like, and what she did and how she lived her life. That's an interesting thing, like what she was as a person living on this earth still exists on some level.
Could there be any personal pattern more distributed than this guy named Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
It's wild. I mean, people are still patterning their lives after these teachings, right? This name is still said all the time. And for a while, when I first came back to faith and I contemplated resurrection, I thought about how Christ is constantly resurrected as people follow and remember him. And as the in a very, very materialist way, the Eucharist, we take bread and wine and turn it into the living body of Christ.
Let's ask that one question. You have that one question.
Okay, so we had a listener question that I really enjoyed. And they said, you know, so we're looking at the ends and we're looking at these signs in the scripture. Well, gosh, we have science. So he mentioned several specific disasters. you know, are earthquakes and tsunamis going up or down? Is violence increasing or decreasing? And what's interesting enough is I actually have done the research to know answers specifically to those questions. Violence globally is going down. The world has never been less violent than it is right now, and we are in a consistent trend of decreasing violence, even when you include the insanity happening in like Russia and the Ukraine or ISIS. It doesn't matter. On a global level, violence is in steep decline. Earthquakes and tsunamis. There's no significant statistical variation happening that is increasing earthquakes or tsunamis, of course, because tsunamis are caused by earthquakes, and there's no sign that those are happening more often. Now, this is what gets interesting to me, though. If you think about weather-based calamities, drought, hurricanes, tornadoes, snowstorms, those are increasing. And they are increasing because of climate change. And I just thought, like, the irony here is man-made climate change and the associated drought and potential disruption to agriculture and those sorts of things could validate the eschatology of people who don't believe in climate change. Because they'll look at those things that are happening in the climate as signs that their belief system is correct, which will encourage them to continue to deny global climate change. Mm-hmm. That's insane.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, like, but so from a real data version, now we'll talk about the science view of eschatology a little bit, and I'll get way more comfortable with the program, is the things the Bible depicts as indicative of the end times, which, by the way, like, for example, Revelation was written in the context of an oppressive government in the Roman Empire, and it was a group desperate to see it fall. And if you look at a lot of the language used there, it has sort of an anti-Roman slant. So, you know, I don't like to take those books and pull them out of context. But I think, obviously, science can inform us dramatically about the way things could play out on very, very long timescales. And so, since we're talking about eschatology, maybe I'll take you through my science-based views on the way things could end.
Okay.
First of all, one I worry about some is actually climate change. We'll probably end up doing an episode on this and talk about it in greater detail, but if you look even biblically, we're set as stewards of the earth right from the beginning. You know, people that use the Bible to defend the idea that we can't affect the earth's environment, well, a literalist take on Genesis says we ate from one tree and changed everything. So somehow God, no matter what your view on the scriptures, you have to say that it looks like God gave us the ability to make dramatic changes to our environment, right? And so a poor caring for our natural habitat, our atmosphere, those things could actually eventually, over a couple hundred years, 500 years, become a real threat to human civilization. That's certainly a possibility. Now, look a little further out. Let's say we work it out. We don't cause the kind of calamity, or it happens gradually enough that we're able to adapt. Because, let's be honest, the climate does change. The planet will warm eventually. The question is how quickly, right? Because we're in an ice age, and sooner or later we're going to be out of this ice age. Anytime you have polar ice caps, you're in an ice age. So if we push the clock out a little further, eventually the sun swells to a red giant and consumes the Earth's orbit. So that's a few billion years. It's a long time, but that's pretty well understood science. Eventually that red giant will, its core will turn into iron, and then it'll turn into a white dwarf, and as doing so just spread out a really, really massive stellar explosion. It won't be a supernova. Our sun's too small, but it'll bake a lot of the solar system. So that'd be a bad thing. But there's some ways that, you know, maybe we don't have to worry about that. But I would say that today in physics, for our observable universe, the understanding of eschatology is eventually everything falls to what we call entropic heat death. The universe's laws of thermodynamics will eventually produce a even distribution of matter and energy at a constant temperature with no more change. That's what physics predicts. Now, people hear that and they say, well, gosh, that's dumb, because all you have to do is look at the Earth and plants are growing, and you scientists say that things are evolving, so obviously entropy doesn't count. It's just an interesting observation, I'll give you that. But of course, the Earth is not a closed system. It is powered by a dying sun. All of our increases in complexity here are funded by the conversion of matter into energy happening through nuclear fusion in our closest star. So would that be the end? Well, it depends on what model of cosmology you look at. We have some problems understanding why the laws of physics exist as they exist, and we have some difficulty accounting for how quantum phenomena occur. And so there are multiple cosmological models that try to explain those difficulties. None of them so far have experimental evidence, and some of them we aren't even sure how we could even conceivably, with increased technology or understanding of the sciences, ever measure. But if you look at any of these models, our observable universe is only part of a larger system, a total universe. One of them looks at universes as being kind of bubbles in a soup of cosmic inflation that never stopped after the Big Bang. That the infinite universe is always infinitely expanding. Sometimes smaller pockets of that infinite universe that are still spatially infinite begin to expand at a speed slower than light speed, at which point you get laws of physics, right? So these universes will all be different, but you would always have new universes. Another one is called comes from superstring theory, and it's called brain theory, B-R-A-N-E theory. And that's the idea that because there are extra dimensions of space-time in string theory, that when a universe approaches heat death, it sags, because you have universes stacked on top of each other centimeters apart, and it taps another universe, at which point you get energy released into both universes. You get two new Big Bangs. And if that's the case, there's never an end. Even in classical single universe inflation, there's a question of eventually does the expansion of the universe stop, and does gravity pull everything back to a singularity? And if that's the case, you have what we call a temporal multiverse, not a spatial multiverse. Yeah, think about how many people have fallen asleep by now. But then if that's the case, you constantly re-roll the dice of the universe and there's no entropic heat death, and there is no eschatology because there is no end. But each time you do this, you may or may not get a universe with life. So that's physics. What if we got a little more, still scientific, but a little more interesting, a little more speculative? There's this thing called the Fermi paradox. And the Fermi paradox basically says there's a lot of stars and there's a lot of planets around those stars. Why aren't there aliens all over the night sky, right? Because you look at the number of planets in the Milky Way alone, and it seems probable in a very old universe, a biogenesis has had a chance to happen pretty frequently. Why is there no life? Why haven't we heard from aliens yet? There's a few solutions to the Fermi paradox. One is that although evolution probably happens everywhere, the jump from single-cell life to multi-cell life is probably really rare. Another is that the jump to an intelligent species, civilization, and culture and technology is really rare. That could be really hopeful for us. And we're working to figure out how likely that is right now. That's why Curiosity is on Mars. If we figure out that there's other life in this solar system on Mars or one of the moons of our gas giants or whatever, that's going to affect the math of how much life there should be out there. So in that idea, we're the first species that's spacefaring. So we're special. That's why nobody else is out there. Another idea is, well, we haven't been looking that long. But if you look at the mathematical models there, if interplanetary travel is possible, and if, depending on how long it takes life to evolve on average into intelligent life forms, some species by now should have colonized this whole galaxy, but they haven't. And that introduces an idea called the great filter. And the great filter is the idea that there is something innate to when life organizes and gains technology that in doing so, they create their own demise inevitably. Some scientists believe that we've already done it. It's called nuclear weapons. So if you consider a statistical probability of nuclear war, in a given year, it's very low. But low probabilities over time become high probabilities. For example, in any given year, it's not very likely that the Earth will be struck by an asteroid. But over 100 million year timelines, it's certain. So there's this possibility that once we invent nuclear weapons, nuclear annihilation is inevitable. That's kind of scary. It's not even the scariest idea, though. It could be some unforeseen thing. For example, what if nanotechnology is possible? What if we can make robots so small they can self-assemble? If nanotechnology can be built, terrorists won. Because all you have to build is like 1,000 self-replicating robots that make more robots out of carbon. At which point, all you would need is one terrorist cell to make
gray
goo, and it'll eat everything on the planet. There's no way to stop it. And that's not even...
People don't know what gray goo is.
Well, it's
some do.
Machines made of...
The people that are still listening do.
We may have lost the art crowd, but the science crowd is really riled up right now. It's machines that are microchip sized, but can do things. You can imagine if you're that small, you could move around molecules the way a forklift moves packages. That's a pretty good analogy. I just came up with that. The one that keeps me up at night and keeps guys like Elon Musk or Stephen Hawking up at night is super intelligent artificial intelligence.
Oh, yes.
And this is the idea that intelligence so far has been a natural phenomenon. And because it's a natural phenomenon, its development is very, very slow. Okay? If you look back at Earth's biohistory, animals existed a long time without being very smart. Once one species got smart, the rate at which things change on this planet exploded exponentially. It's insane how quickly things changed when humans got smart and then learned to write things down and could pass knowledge generationally at high fidelity. So what we found is when you introduce artificial selection into a system, things get fast, mm-hmm. right?
Dogs
change all the time because instead of this chaotic process happening with selection pressures, humans go, I want a puppy that fits in my purse, mm-hmm. and they make one. Mm-hmm. So now we're making machines that think right now, and you use them all the time. If you Google, you're asking an artificial intelligence to do work for you. And Google, I mean, come on, we're used to it now. But a little hint, I saw one of the founders of Google at a trade show before Google was Google, and he talked about his idea, and all the nerds kind of laughed him out of the conference, wow. right? Because we were like, you could never have enough computers to scan the whole internet.
Wow.
And he's like, yeah, I can. And I'm going to have a lot more money than all of you. But everywhere we look, think about chess. Computers went from being ridiculous opponents to now the good computers are unbeatable, right? Now, but that's just chess. Well, IBM's Watson did great playing Jeopardy, a natural language game. And that same algorithm now is starting to out-diagnose human doctors when evaluating medical conditions. But those are all specific contexts. So those are what we call a purpose-built artificial intelligence. Kind of the holy grail of AI is a general intelligence, something that can make decisions and do things on its own and can even at that point begin to modify itself. We already produce math that is self-programming to some degree because we have what we call genetic algorithms. algorithms that live or die based on their success on a criteria that we seed with mutations. And some of those work on the stock market and occasionally cause market crashes, right? Because we have these supercomputers doing high-speed trading. But the idea is, if an AI can write its own code and ever become self-aware, it will go from like monkey smart to kid smart to the same difference between us and it as we are to ants in hours or days. Because computers, tick, 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 they run so fast, right? Now, how feasible is this? And what would they do? So there's one thing that bugs me is people think like an AI is going to be like Terminator, is going to wipe us all out. We're aggressive because we have a limbic system. That's why we're aggressive. Computers do not have a limbic system. And I assume we would not put a limbic system into a machine. That would be a terrible plan. But the fear that very smart people have is that we create our demise on accident. Okay? So let's look at a couple possible outcomes. So the first idea is, well, we'd be in control. So we take our potentially super intelligent machine, we put it in a box, and then we feed it questions and we get answers. So you can imagine if we somehow created this super intelligent machine and we said, how do we fix climate change? And we fed it in on like a written card and all it has is a printer and it prints out answers. Well, if you were locked in a bedroom and your four-year-old was on the other side of the door, how hard would it be for you to answer questions in a way that manipulated your four-year-old into letting you out of the room? It'd be pretty easy. You're a lot smarter than a four-year-old, right? So it would be really easy for a computer to seed its own escape from the situation and take control, because we'd be like ants in intelligence level. But then why would the computer care? Well, the computer is going to try to do whatever directive we give it. So if you tell a super intelligent AI, your goal is to maximize human happiness, you can imagine that computer might build a robot army to subjugate us, put cranial caps on all of us and stimulate our pleasure centers and keep us in a state of happy coma.
Right? Maybe that's awesome, though.
An unthinking, just awesome forever. And harvesting our DNA to make more humans and ensure the survival of the species.
Maybe that's the renewal of all things.
That's heaven. That's what's forecast.
And the seven-headed beasts and stuff. Maybe, you know, maybe they give us multiple brains for happiness. Maybe the Revelation guy just saw it. You know? He just looked forward. He's like, look at that. There's a sword coming out of that guy's mouth. And it like literally is like a...
Oh. All right, total aside, because that's an absurd notion. But you got me interested. How would a first century Jew living in Rome describe Mars Curiosity if they saw it? Like, what would they think that was on this red terrain, like with a big robot head and eyes and this drill digging into the ground?
And the beast came out of the sea.
That's absurd.
And the moon turned to blood.
So that's it. We just figured it out.
We did. They saw it.
They saw AI take over.
All right. Sorry to interrupt you. Go.
That's all right. So there's a great example from like my favorite blog, which is Wait But Why, to really spell this scenario out, how it could play out. So let's suppose we continue to get better at artificial intelligence programming. And Google and Facebook and Apple sign a treaty that says if you're making an AI, you can't connect it to the internet for obvious reasons. And because they're really smart, the world government signed it as well, and everyone agrees AIs don't connect to the internet. And this one team realizes, the startup company, that handwritten cards get opened more often than machine-printed cards. And even if you print like a font on the letter, the fact that there was no pen stroke, people, because human brains are great pattern recognition machines, they don't open the envelopes. So they make a robot, an artificial intelligent robot, whose job is to make great handwritten cards. And its job, it's got a camera and a robotic arm. It looks at the way people write things and then uses that to develop better and better handwriting. That's its only job. And its directive that they program into this machine is make the best handwritten cards you possibly can. And it just, it's constantly doing this. And they get a little press because their algorithms are so good and this learning is so good that this thing gets about to the conversational level of a four-year-old. And they, like, make the cover of magazines and, you know, BuzzFeed does memes about them. It's a really exciting thing. And then they're in the lab one night and they see on a tech blog another company has a handwriting robot and it's actually making better cards than theirs. And they're about to go to round two funding in their VC. So they're venture capital. They're trying to raise money. And this could, like, steal their thunder. And about that time, their little AI robot says, I could write way better if I had more samples. Could I connect to the internet for an hour? In its really simplistic terms. They say, okay, that's fine. We don't want to lose our funding. So what we're going to do is we're going to put a machine here. We're going to monitor everything the AI does. So we can pull the plug at any moment if it does anything nefarious. And great. So they connect it to the internet. And all it does is go to Google Images and search handwritten notes. And just analyze pictures for an hour and downloads a ton of pictures. And then disconnects itself. It's really well behaved. And nothing happens except its handwriting gets better and they get their funding. 3 weeks later, one of the lab techs gets a cough. And 2 days later, every human on the planet is dead. Because the AI, when it got intelligent enough as a four-year-old, realized humans were a threat to its mission. That if they realized it was getting smart enough to fulfill its mission, they would unplug it. And they were also convenient sources of carbon. So it connected to the internet, outsmarted the people monitoring it, and started up a nanobot fabrication facility and engineered robots that would kill all humans, but never tipped its hand until it was ready. At which point, it converts all of the plants and trees and animals on the planet into robotic arms and stacks of paper, where it practices its handwriting. And it realizes that it's running out of resources on the planet, so it begins to build rocket ships and launching them across the solar system to get more materials from asteroids. The next thing you know, Mars and Venus and Mercury and all these planets are nothing but oceans of robotic arms practicing their handwriting. The next thing you know, it runs out of materials in the solar system, and because robots don't age, launches probes for the nearest stars where it will what? Convert everything into robots making handwritten cards. And that story sounds ridiculous, but it's such a good illustration. Right. It's such a good illustration of the potential unforeseen circumstances of an intelligence we create that is both much, much, much smarter than us and completely alien in its motivations.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy stuff.
We would call that non-biblical eschatology.
Or maybe it's literal.
Maybe. Maybe that's what happened. It was a warning sign.
Oh, man.
But so here's my thing. Obviously, I don't know what happens. I don't know how things end. I do let the sciences inform me about what's probable or possible. I roll with that. So as much as that sounds absurd, I am a computer guy more than anything. And so as much as I can be a part of those discussions and aware of those discussions and help people be aware of the ethical implications of science. This is where we get back to science, art, and faith in this program to me. I think it's important that people of faith let their faith inform these kinds of decisions. What are we willing to trade in convenience and in terms for potential risks? Does faith have a role in guiding the hand of science and being involved in ethical discussions? If we wall ourselves off and just say, well, we're just waiting for the fire escape, we're not involved in very important issues and topics. If we use our eschatology to deny things like climate change, we can't be a force for the renewal of the world. So for me, the science tells me what is and what is probable in the future. My faith tells me what to hope for and what to work for. So it's a faith issue for me to eat less meat. It's a faith issue for me to be aware of the potential dangers of AI or nanotechnology. Even though they're informed by science, for me, they are issues of faith.
Well, here's what's interesting about Christian eschatology. Because where we, as human beings, we've been so self-centric always, you know, our first scientific models of Earth put us right at the middle of every, in the whole universe. We're the middle, of course. And we thought, oh, we're not the middle. Well, at least, you know, our sun must be the middle. Oh, no, I guess it's not the middle. You know, it's like we're not even in the middle of our own galaxy. So I think our modern scientific understandings should influence our view of eschatology. If we're talking about the renewal of all things, you have to realize Earth is a dot. It's the pale blue dot. It's a speck of dust in this vast, potentially multiverse that we are a part of. And so even if that's what happens, you know, like AI takes over and kills all humans, to me, I think the Christian eschatology should continually like bring us out to bigger views of both ourselves and of humanity and all things being connected and all things together, because we are not just this matter, right? We're not just these protons and neutrons and all this stuff. There is something about us that is, we're stories, right? We exist in, or, you know, whether those stories are still made up of protons, neutrons, whatever, I don't know. But the point is, it's not so simple as I'm this body and then I die and it's gone. There's a lot more mystery and a lot more nuance to it than that, I think. And there's this spirit element to us. There's a story element of how we relate to other people and what we, how we as humanity live. So if there is some, if God is real, you know, if God has love for us and we matter to God, maybe that story that we are, that collection of stories, those series of loops are held within God somehow, you know, that even if we do die this heat death, if AI takes over, whatever, it crunches back together and a new universe emerges. Who know? How do we know? We don't know what happens, but, you know, but after that, if our stories are still contained within God, if that's where it's all leading, I still find value in the Christian hope, I guess, is what I'm saying. Even if,
yes,
even if it's not an immediate escape, even if, you know, like if the earth is going to die or whatever, and it's not going to have some grand restoration before that happens, the story is larger than Earth.
My skeptical friends say, so what if you're wrong about Jesus? I go, so what if I'm wrong about Jesus, right? The things I believe about Jesus change my life in ways that help me and help me be a positive agent in the world. And empiricists, free thinkers believe eventually it's curtains for this planet, but they don't find hopelessness in that. And so I acknowledge the possibility, even the likelihood, that eventually it's curtains for this planet. But that doesn't make this moment futile. And it doesn't make my hope for God's continuing work of salvation futile, because it changes this moment. Well, obviously, this is a very open discussion, so we would love to hear your thoughts on eschatology. Come join us on facebook.com/theliturgists, tweet us at theliturgists, or you can even comment on the episode directly on theliturgists.com/podcast, where I've actually been making an effort to show up and respond to your comments lately. Guys, thank you for listening to the program. If you want to help other people discover conversations about science, art, and faith, the best thing you can do, number one most helpful thing, is to rate the show on iTunes. It makes a huge difference in how many people discover the program. Thanks to all you people who have. Our show is produced by Joel Marchand, who we appreciate his great work. Thanks for hanging out with us. I'm Science Mike.
I'm Michael Gunger. Talk to you guys later.